It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
And Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins are with us from Harvell & Collins. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
Morning, Ben.
All right, what are we talking about today?
Ben, we're going to talk about an element, if you will, or procedure relative to guardianships. Mm-hmm. Many times here on the program, Wes and I have discussed guardianships. And that, of course, basically is the procedure where due to accident, illness, due to advanced age, whatever the case might be, that the factual precedent has been established that this person is no longer able to make competent decisions relative to their care, mm-hmm. medically, to their person, or to their property, or combinations of the two. In other words, you can have a guardian of the property, but a different guardian for the person, different combinations can exist. But what we want to talk about today is that this is an interesting area of the law in that this is not irrevocable. This mm-hmm. is not always a permanent decision. And so Wes and I today want to talk about what would be known as a restoration of rights under a guardianship proceeding.
Okay. All right. So again, because of accident, any number of reasons people put into that position, well, that changes.
That's right. You know, I think a good place to start with this as well is that, you know, just because someone has lost their capacity to make decisions for themselves through whatever it might be, an accident, we might not be able to get their medications regulated, mm-hmm. and they might have some mental illness, something like that. Just because they lose that capacity doesn't mean that they need to be adjudicated incompetent and for a guardian to be appointed. I mean, if you have a good, solid power of attorney
right.
that has all the right language in it, mm-hmm. and your power of attorney, or attorney in fact is really the proper term, is doing a good job for you, then sometimes, you know, you deal with these guardianship hearings where maybe the person is clearly incompetent, but the clerk makes a determination that there's not a necessity in this case mm-hmm. to appoint a guardian because the power of attorney is doing a great job.
Right.
So we do see that sometimes because ultimately what we're looking at is what is in the best interest of this respondent, mm-hmm. what is in the best interest of this person so that they're not being taken advantage of by other persons financially or otherwise. Mm-hmm. So, but in the event that we don't have that good power of attorney, we don't have someone who is taking care of this person who has diminished capacity, then in many cases the court will appoint a guardian, make the finding that the person is incompetent, and then appoint a guardian, as Cecil said, either guardian of the person or guardian of the person and guardian of the estate,
right.
or general guardian, which is both, just mm-hmm. depending on what the circumstances are. But nevertheless, when this person is adjudicated incompetent, you know, their rights to do things, our liberties, are really taken away. Mm-hmm. You know, the right to contract, the right to vote, the right to do, you know, the things that we take for granted just as an American, you know, mm-hmm. to make decisions, you know, for yourself. Because the court has made the determination that this person, at least at this point in time, is incompetent. So, however, we do have cases that over time, maybe the person may regain some capacity. You know, I think the more prevalent cases are ones where you have folks that have mental illness mm-hmm. that the medication has just gotten way off, or the
right.
person's not taking the medication, and we have situations where the person just has manic episodes or has, you know, various things that pop up mm-hmm. from as it relates to their incapacity and mental illness. You know, they go on these episodes where they wander down the street, or you know, they're just out there doing things that are unsafe. So, however, you know, we see folks in this type of situation sometimes, where their competency or capacity can be improved, you know, medically through their medications mm-hmm. or whatever it might be. And then there is that procedure where we can go back to the court and we can ask for that competency to be restored. Because, you know, once the court, and it's the clerk of court who makes this decision,
right.
once the court makes that determination that the person is incompetent, then that person is forever incompetent.
Until
they reapply and are successful in proving that their competency should be restored.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Now, on that, could it be restored to the position where the healthcare power of attorney takes over? Or does the person who is declared incompetent have to be the one who seeks that restoration?
Okay. As far as the individual who seeks the restoration,
mm-hmm.
it could be the ward. That's the person who is declared incompetent.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, usually that's who it is, by the way. It could mm-hmm. be a family member. It could even be the guardian.
Right. You know,
the guardian could make the determination that, hey, I don't need to be a guardian anymore. I don't need to do these accountings
right.
every year anymore. I don't need to make decisions for my sister, you mm-hmm. know, or whomever it may be anymore, because she's doing pretty well at this point in time, and it's now time for the competency to be restored. So the law leaves it pretty much wide open as far as those who are interested in the ward as to who can petition to have that competency restored. Now, the process is a little interesting because, you know, you think about, all right, we've got someone who's adjudicated incompetent.
Right.
Well, that means they can't make decisions for themselves. That means they can't contract. That means they can't do much of anything. However, in the statute, it's carved out
mm-hmm.
where they do have that right to
they can do this
to petition and to hire a lawyer to do
right,
it.
Right.
Okay. So once the petition is filed, normally, depending on the circumstances, normally the court is going to look at, you know, the facts and circumstances and probably at that point in time request or order a multidisciplinary evaluation
mm-hmm.
if it's a close case. If it's not a close case at all, it might not be necessary for that.
Mm-hmm.
The court is also going to appoint a guardian ad litem. This is an attorney who basically kind of oversees the ward to make sure that the ward's rights are being protected. This would be in addition to any attorney that the ward already has.
Right.
Okay, because there's a different dynamic there.
This is really like for the judge or the clerk to actually take advice from.
It's a very interesting situation because, you know, let's say someone was adjudicated incompetent, but maybe they have returned to a higher level of functioning compared to what they had before.
Mm-hmm.
So they hire an attorney, or maybe with the help of their family member, or family members, they hire an attorney to petition to have that competency restored. Well, really the job of their attorney that they've hired is to zealously represent the interest of their client.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning if the client, meaning the ward, says, I want my competency restored, well, that's really what that attorney is trying to achieve mm-hmm. for the client.
Right.
But the guardian ad litem, their job is to protect the ward. The guardian ad litem's position could be, well, I understand, Ms. Ward, mm-hmm. that you want your capacity and competency to be restored, but I don't think it's in your best interest to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the report of the guardian ad litem, although the guardian ad litem is really acting as the attorney for the ward, could report to the court, it's my opinion, Madam Clerk, that I don't think that competency needs to be restored because of whatever deficiencies the guardian ad litem sees.
Well, I mean, I can imagine a scenario like that where, for example, the brother-in-law is the attorney,
right?
And the brother's wife, who is the direct relative, may benefit from something from.
Well, there's all kind of cases like that, Ben, where there's someone who is interested in moving forward with this restoration of competency really for some ulterior motive. And mm-hmm. usually there's some dollar signs at the end
yep.
of that.
You always follow the money.
Yeah.
Follow the money. That's right.
Yes. Well, it's just such an interesting area of the law because it is one that I think is probably hidden away from a lot of people. They just don't even know this even happens.
It is very private. Not particularly a matter of common knowledge, these proceedings.
Not headline making.
No, it isn't. But very emotional, very usually, you know, a lot of emotion in files like mm-hmm. this, because after all, someone in the family is having their legal rights altered.
Mm-hmm.
diminished, if you will. Someone is taking over their financial well-being. Someone is taking over, very likely, their medical well-being. And it's very important that this be a person that is really going to act in the best interest of the adjudicated incompetent person. The procedures, of course, would require, the law then, of course, requires that there be accountings, that there mm-hmm. be, that there be review processes relative to this, as there should be. And one of this, of course, is the fact that at any given time, any interested party can come forth and say,
that's right.
this person yeah. does not need, a guardian anymore. They can, they now can make their own decisions.
We'll have more to come in a moment here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station and Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. You can always find out more information about them as well at harvellandcollins.com. And welcome back to the program. Good to have you along with us here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station. Of course, Let's Talk Legal every Tuesday morning at this time with Harvell and Collins, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the firm. And so we're talking about incompetency and restoration of competency.
Right. So we talked about, you know, once someone is adjudicated incompetent, you know, if they improve to the point where possibly their competency could be restored, then there's a process where you go back before the court, you file that petition. Then we go through this procedure. Guardian ad litem is appointed, mm-hmm. as we just talked about. In some cases, a multidisciplinary evaluation would be ordered. Parties do have the right to ask for that.
Mm-hmm.
That would be like a neuropsych evaluation performed by, you know, an unaffiliated party, a mm-hmm. doctor, clinical psychologist of some sort appointed by the court. And then we move forward to, you know, the hearing. At the hearing, you know, it could go one of two ways with regard to the presentation of evidence and who makes the final determination. Certain individuals, including the ward, have the right to request a jury trial. The guardian ad litem also has a right to request a jury trial.
Really?
Yes. And the clerk, on her or his own motion, have a right to require a jury trial. And it's a jury of six, not a typical jury of 12.
Mm-hmm.
So the jury of six would be picked in a typical voir dire situation of selecting jurors, and then they make the factual determination as to whether the person is not incompetent or mm-hmm. not, or whether their competency should be restored. Or it could be just a hearing before the single person being the clerk of superior court, you know, to make that determination.
Right.
Right. So, but the burden of proof on this, of course, falls with the petitioner, falls with the person who's asking for the competency to be restored. Usually this person is going to testify, mm-hmm. At the hearing. Obviously the clerk is going to want to hear from the mm-hmm. person who thinks their capacity has been restored, and the clerk should take into consideration, and usually does take into consideration, the particular circumstances involving this person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if there's a situation where this person is through, their competency being restored is going to have access to significant funds. I mean, let's say that this is
right.
this is a situation where
right.
they were in an accident years ago,
mm-hmm.
and there was a large recovery as a result of that. Well, they may be subject to influence from others. Well, the clerk needs to take into consideration, is this person going to have access to significant funds and maybe be higher or subject to a higher level of influence from others because of that?
Right.
Or is this someone who really, there's no dollars and cents issue here.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obviously it would be difficult for a lot of people to deal with the influences of others, family members, so on and so
sure,
forth.
Sure. And more family members come out of the woodwork when there's not a lot that, of dollars.
That's right.
Signs.
So those kind of issues, you know, are mm-hmm. relevant to determine, does this person have the level of capacity necessary to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were previously adjudicated incompetent, then obviously that raises an issue about, you know, whether they have recovered to the point where, you know, they can protect themselves, they can stand up for themselves, or are they going to, you know, potentially give in to the undue influence. So sometimes these guardianship hearings get to be a little more far reaching than just the medical issue of, you know, how you're doing today,
mm-hmm.
because we have to see what's going on in the person's life.
You know, Cecil, you have mentioned before, like when you're interviewing somebody, getting ready to prepare a will or some things, that you ask questions about, do you know the objects of your bounty and where your money is? And are the questions more particular than that, that may be asked to the person who's seeking restoration? Or is that good evidence?
No, it would be more significant than just that. Mm-hmm. They really do. They need to. It needs to be clear that they have the ability to manage their affairs and to be able to really handle their medical needs, their medical decisions, as well as their financial decisions. One more thing we might say here, Ben, is that these guardianships, as I've mentioned, we've both mentioned, they're closely monitored. Mm-hmm. For instance, we have a file in our office right now where through the guardian we are needing to sell their real property.
Right.
This is not something that the guardian is going to be able to do without getting an order from the court first to sell real property. That's a very significant financial decision, and that needs additional court approval. So those are the kinds of things where we see these guardianships once they are established. You know, there continues to be monitoring, if you will, of the actions of the guardian. Of course, there are accountings that have to be made.
Mm-hmm.
There are bonds that have to be posted. And all of those things are necessary. But any significant decision like the selling of a piece of real property or the purchase of a real property, these would be the kinds of things that the court would come in and probably through motion approve.
Right, right. Again, a strong burden there on the petitioner.
That's right. Also, I would say that some of our statutes, unfortunately, are a little bit behind with regard to this as well. If you look at the restoration statutes in North Carolina, they indicate that the clerk shall immediately set the hearing date, and the hearing date should be between 10 days and 30 days from date of service of the petition. So that's a really fast period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the idea there of the General Assembly when they put that in place was that, you know, if someone is in a condition where their competency, or they think their competency has recovered to the point that they should be restored, we want that to happen quickly because we don't want people out, you know, being adjudicated incompetent who shouldn't be. However, what I think is a more important issue in the many of these type cases I've dealt with is that the clerk normally wants to give all of the parties plenty of time to get all the evidence together.
Right.
Because this is an incredibly important decision. The clerk needs to understand the complete medical dynamic, needs to understand the financial dynamic, needs to understand the family dynamic. And sometimes it takes some time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, like we were talking about a moment ago, for someone who has had an injury of some sort, who's in an accident of some sort, and maybe they were in a coma when they were adjudicated incompetent.
Right.
And then maybe years later, you know, we're back in court, there's been some recovery, and maybe their competency is going to be restored. Well, any neuropsych evaluation, they're going to want to look at those medical records.
Right.
Well, you can't just wave a magic wand and get those within 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of times it takes a lot of, you know, time to get those medical records so that the neuropsych evaluator would be able to, not only understand how the person is presenting today.
So does the court
but what the injury is.
Does the court have the ability to waive that?
I was going to return to that. The issue with that is for good cause shown, the clerk does have a right to set the hearing out further. Okay. But they have to set it between 10 and 30 days when the petition is served, when it's filed. So, but normally, I've never had a restoration case where it's been between 10 and 30 days. It's always months.
We'll have more to come in a moment here with Let's Talk Legal with Harbell and Collins. You can call and make your appointment at 726-9050, and we'll have more in just a bit. We're we're talking about restoration of competency and the hoops that you go through. I mean, it sounds like it's actually more complicated to undo than to declare the competency in the first place, because that may be pretty obvious.
Right. It can be. It really is like starting over. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's a close case in a guardianship, then it's a pretty onerous task, no matter if you're talking about a petition for adjudication of incompetence. If it's contested, then it's going to be basically a mini trial. If it's a restoration.
As you said, you're taking someone's rights away.
Right.
So you have to be very careful about that. And then even undoing that, still very careful.
You have to be very careful about it. And, you really have to gather all the evidence that the court should want to see and consider to make a complete decision for this person. This is not a let's show up, have a little sit down meeting and see how the person, talks today.
Right.
Because listen, I've done this many times before. There are folks out there who cope very well. They have learned how to cope. They know how to have a conversation with someone to make them look like they remember everything and know everything, and they're just as clear as the next guy.
They've learned how to count their months backwards.
But when they go through a proper neuropsych evaluation, the deficiencies are then revealed, because, obviously that's the purpose of the MDE. Mm-hmm. That's the purpose of the multidisciplinary evaluation, to get down to whether this person, when they get into the real life and real life decisions and making hard decisions, financial decisions, medical decisions, dealing with influence from others, are they going to be able to stand up for themselves? Are they going to be able to protect themselves? And maybe they appear that they would be able to do that if you were having a conversation with them on a street corner. But the purpose of, giving us time and getting the medical evidence together is so that we understand all of the deficiencies this person may have.
And once again, this is a petition that's brought usually as, again, the person's rights have been taken away, but they're the one who generally brings this petition forward.
Usually.
Yeah, the ward.
Yep. And, like I said, in many cases, it's, a situation where someone's medication was off.
You mentioned about the guardian ad litem coming in and their influence there too. Well, I can see where sometimes the guardian ad litem might be a third set of eyes that sees where the money is that
Correct.
The others are not necessarily being forthcoming about.
Well, that's right, and that's an interesting dynamic too. I know we just have about a minute left, but the guardianship only has jurisdiction over the assets of the ward. But let's say someone was in an accident years ago and a trust was set up for them.
Right.
And there's lots of money in this trust over here. And maybe if this person's competency is restored, then they have a right to do things in the trust that otherwise they would not have a right to do. So the guardianship doesn't have jurisdiction over the assets in the trust.
Right.
But in that type of situation, and we see that, special needs trust being set up for someone.
Yeah.
In that type of situation, the clerk should want to know about that trust as well and know what the impact of her decision would be.